Okay, let's get started. Today's Dvar Torah is, in some ways, part two of last week's Dvar Torah. I'm going to pick up on some of the themes that I started off with last week and look at an issue I raised last week from a different perspective based upon this week's parsha. So, as I say, it's a kind of a part two of last week's part one Dvar Torah. You'll recall, last week, I focused primarily on Moshe Rabbeinu's mysterious and troubling encounter with death at the inn. But I spoke as well about Moshe Rabbeinu's plaint to Hashem, Lama Hari Osa L'Am Hazeh. Why did you do such harm to Bnei Yisrael? How could you have done such harm to them? You made things worse. You told me to go redeem them, and now instead of redeeming them, they have more work to do, and they're suffering even more. Why have you done such evil to this people? Why have you sent me? So, at one level, we assume that Moshe Rabbeinu believed that Hashem would redeem Bnei Yisrael. So, what exactly was his complaint? So I came to Medrash, which I saw cited in the Sefer. It's in this week's Parsha, the very end of the Parsha. Cites a machlokas between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yishmael's position is really quite puzzling, which I won't go into right now because it's a bit off track for me. But Rabbi Akiva maintains as follows. Rabbi Akiva Omer, he's commenting on the second half of the pasuk, Lama Hariyosa Lama Ze Lama Ze Shlachtani, Vahatzeh Lo Hitzalta, you haven't been saved Bnei Yisrael, you've made things worse. Rabbi Akiva says, Yodea Ani Sha'ata Asid Lahatzilam, I know that in the future you will save them, Elama Ichpas Lacha Biosan Hanisunim Tachas Abinyan, but don't you care about those who are placed under the building? So what he's doing is he's parsing the two verbs, the hatzel lohitzalta, which the Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael too were puzzled by why the double language, the hatzel lohitzalta. Why not just say lohitzalta? He didn't say why the hatzel lohitzalta. So Rabbi Akiva distinguishes between present and future, and what he says is, I know that the hatzel, in the future, you will save Bnei Yisrael, you'll redeem them and bring them to out of Mitzrayim. Lo hitzalta, but in the present, you did not save Bnei Yisrael. And in fact, you allowed them to be buried under the building. And this is a reference to something the Medrash says on the page before, which is, I think, somewhat well known. The Medrash claims that, as you know, Bnei Yisrael were punished by Paro and told that they would have to provide their own kash, their own straw to make the bricks, and it would not be provided for them, which made it much, much more difficult in the limited time that they had to not only get the fine, the straw, but make the bricks and build the building. So they had less time and they didn't build as much. But the officers of the Egyptians insisted that they build as much as they used to build, which is what Paro told them to. And so what the officers, horrific creatures that they were, did was they took Jews and threw their bodies into the construction of the building to make up the missing space, which resulted from their not working as in building as much because they didn't have the kash, the straw given to them. In other words, let's say they used to build 3 feet a day, but because they now had to collect the kash, they could only do 2.5 feet a day. So they had to do the extra work of collecting the straw. And so they would throw human beings, Jews, into the building to make up the missing space, which is really a horrific idea, really Nazi-esque in its terrible, terrible implications. But in any case, Rabbi Akiva is saying, like Hashem, I know that Moshe, in putting this in Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth, Hashem, I know that you will eventually in the future save Bnei Yisrael. What about the terrible, terrible suffering of Bnei Yisrael in the present? How do you balance or weigh present suffering against future redemption. While redemption will take place in the future, Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to Hashem, how can you tolerate this horrific behavior on the part of the Egyptians against the Jewish people? They're stuffing them under the building. They're putting them in the place of bricks. They're treating human beings like bricks. They're killing them. Hashem, how could you tolerate that? And that was the conundrum that Moshe Rabbeinu was throwing at Hashem. And that's a really difficult question. To what extent should one tolerate suffering pro tem if it leads to a better and greater future? And let me frame that question by following through on the psukim. Because after Moshe Rabbeinu says that, what does Hashem say? Hashem says to them, this is now in our parsha, the beginning of the parsha, "Vagam ani shamati es nakas b'nei Yisrael," and I too have heard the moaning and the groaning of B'nai Yisrael because of what the Egyptians do to them. "Lochein emor l'B'nai Yisrael," and therefore say to B'nai Yisrael, "Ani Hashem, hotzviotzesi eschem mitachas sivos Mitzrayim." I'm skipping around a little. I will take them out of the burdens of Mitzrayim. I will save them. I will redeem them. I will take them. "Lakachti eschem li'li'am," I will take them for me as a people. "Oyisi lachem le'lokim," and I will be for them as a God. And "veivesi eschem el ha'aretz asher nasasi es yadi lases osa lavram yitzhak u'yaakov," and I will carry them, bring them to the land that I promised to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, morasha, as a eternal inheritance to them. So what Hashem is responding is to Moshe Rabbeinu, is you can't look only at the present. There is a grand, great vision for a new future. And that new future is one of your own land, the land Hashem promised B'nai Yisrael, the special relationship, the Mefarshim say, our reference to Matan Torah. What Hashem is saying is you can't be stuck in the present. You have to look to the long-term future. There is a vision. And that vision for a great new future should be able to sustain you during periods of terrible suffering. And as I was thinking about this present suffering versus long-term future, I couldn't help but think of certain instances in history which I think reflected this phenomenon. So if you think of soldiers in the Great Generation, there are many examples of this, but let's say soldiers in the Great Generation who fought during World War II, the Battle of the Bulge, I mean, the invasion of Normandy. I mean, people just went to their death. You see, I didn't see the movie D-Day, but some of you may have seen the movie D-Day. It was a very bloody, bloody depiction of what happened in the invasion on D-Day. And these are people who step to their death or to brutal battle involving many, many horrible, horrible wounds. And what partially motivated them was a desire to save their families, the United States, and the whole Western world from Nazism. Now, what's the calculus there? Like, what are they thinking? How could they have done that? I mean, how could they have sacrifice their own personal lives and well-being for some abstract good? And the answer is that somehow or other, people are capable of that. And I'll give you another example, and that is those farmers and yeshiva bacharim and amateurs who fought during the War of Independence in the Haganah. These were really, many of them were not soldiers. Some of them had a little bit of training. Some of them were Holocaust survivors, just come out of the camps 3 or 4 years earlier. Some were yeshiva bacham. I mean, yeshiva bacham are generally not very good at weaponry. I see Burdette is saying her father fought in both. Wow, that's pretty impressive. So, think about this. Yeshiva bacham going to war. It's like so far removed from their mentality. And farmers, simple people. And yet they went to war knowing that many, people to the right and people to the left were killed or wounded terribly and maimed. And nevertheless, they were motivated by this vision that the Jewish people could have a state of their home or their own where they could take refuge, where they could build their own world and not be dependent upon the gola and the well and the favor, good favor, ill favor of their host nations. And the capacity to fight towards a vision is capable of enabling people to endure terrible suffering if they know that there is some greater end. And I'll give you a third example of this, nothing that I have personally experienced myself, but some of you here have, and that is childbirth. Childbirth is, from what I gather, an extremely painful experience. And yet some women have many children, and they're willing to endure the pain of childbirth because of the baby that will soon be nestling in their arms. That is, the vision of a future has the capacity to cognitively reframe and emotionally, therefore, reframe how they experience the suffering of the present. And it's one of the great, remarkable qualities of the human condition. Animals fight. You know, I'm not an animal psychologist. I don't know what goes on inside animals' heads, but I certainly have my doubts as to whether the capacity to give up one's life for a transcendent good, for a vision of a new future, is something that animals can experience. I don't know, but it is, I think, remarkable that we human beings have the capacity to rise above our present suffering because of a vision of a new future. And that's really what Hashem was telling Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes, I see the Na'akas B'nai Yisrael, they're throwing the Jews under the binyan, but this will lead to a better future, believe me. And if one can accept that belief and reframe thereby their experience of the present, it becomes more possible to endure suffering in the present because it will lead to, based upon faith, a greater good. And all those examples I've given you are, I think, examples of what this parsha is teaching us as I read it. And I think, you know, it's applicable, it's in some respects, to what we're all going through now. I don't want to compare Avdus and Mitzrayim to a pandemic, but I guess I am. Clearly, it's not the same, and that was a lot worse in many ways, but we're certainly going through a very hard time. Fortunately, a very close friend of ours, close family friend of ours for many, many decades, was just taken to the hospital yesterday or 2 days ago with suffering from COVID, was in the ICU. Baruch Hashem, she was just taken out of the ICU, but people all around us we know get sick, sometimes unfortunately seriously, and there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of sickness all around us. You know, the incredible political instability and unrest, what we witnessed last week in Capitol Hill, it's just, you know, the mobs and the rioting, it's a really rough time. And I don't want to say it's like being thrown under a building when a building is being built, but that I don't want to underrate the traumas that many of us are experiencing and the anxiety and the difficulty. And I think that a lesson to be learned from this way of thinking about the Parsha is that if one can focus on the Geula Ha'asida, you know, a future redemption, that things will get better, that vaccines are coming around the corner, and that, you know, I guess it was, maybe it's the current issue of Atlantic Magazine, maybe last week, last month's issue, a long, long article about the pandemic. And much of it was focused on the ways in which the pandemic has improved medicine, cures, the capacity for vaccines. Even terrible things can sometimes lead a glimmer towards new horizons. And if we can focus on the better horizons, you know, the better future, the Geula HaSida, as Hashem insisted that Moshe Rabbeinu and Bnei Yisrael focus on, then it makes it easier for us to get through the slog of the present. If we cannot focus on the slog of the present, but do our best to focus on the glimmers of hope, which are clearly around the corner, vaccines. I don't know how many of you here got a vaccine, but I managed to sneak one in, Baruch Hashem. Got my first one a couple of days ago. Wasn't easy. I mean, I was eligible for it, being an educator, but I had to do some serious histodlus, and I had a lot of siyata dishmaya, and I was able to get the vaccine. But the vaccines are around the corner. You know, people, more and more people are getting it. And that's a glimmer of hope towards a different future. And we need to be focused on the hope rather than, to the extent that we can, rather than on the slogging difficulties of the present. And I want to now focus my attention on why it is so difficult to get out of the difficulties of the present. Why is it so hard to reframe our way of thinking and feeling? And the Torah says, I want to look at different readings of what the Torah says. The Torah says, Lo shamu el Moshe. Bnei Yisrael did not listen to Moshe Rabbeinu. Mikotza ruach ume avoda kasha. Out of, literally translated, shortness of breath and hard work. So avoda kasha has a simple reading, hard work. I'll get to that in a minute. But kotza ruach is an unusual phrase in the Torah. Shortness of breath, like, what does that mean? And you know, as I was looking into it, I was found it really quite interesting. It's not so common that virtually every one of the Mefarshim in the Mikraos Gedolos, which is the classic compendium of Mefarshim to the Torah, virtually every one of the Mefarshim has a different explanation of that somewhat unusual phrase. And in that sense, each one offers what to taken together what might be called a typology of why it's difficult to look at that Geula HaSida, that Lo Shamu El Moshe, they didn't listen to Moshe. What makes it so difficult to extricate ourselves from burdens of the present? So Rashi translates Kotza Ruach literally, shortness of breath. And what he says is, and this is so interesting and really very true, I actually read about this once, people who suffer from severe anxiety often don't breathe properly. Did you know that? That people who suffer, I read about this. The people who suffer from severe anxiety don't breathe properly. They often have short, shallow breathing. People under great stress. You ever notice that? Have you ever noticed that in yourself sometimes? When you're under a lot of stress, short, shallow breathing, you don't really get enough oxygen, which is in itself not a great thing. So kotza ruach, Rashi says, is a sign of meitzar, a sign of distress. And that's a physiological response to stress and to anxiety and distress. And the kotza ruach is a physiological, physical manifestation of a psychological phenomenon, which is severe anxiety and stress. And what Rashi is saying on this reading is that Bnei Yisrael couldn't hear Moshe Rabbeinu because they were under such stress, felt such anxiety, they couldn't escape the prison of that stress and anxiety. And that clearly is afflicting many people during the pandemic. It's really hard to get out of that. That's one reading. Rashi, Musaf Rashi, Rashi in other words, elsewhere, not in Chumash, I don't remember where it is, but I have another parish in my Mikraos Gedolos called Musaf Rashi, where this parish cites Rashi, who discusses this elsewhere in Tanakh. And Rashi there says, let me read it to you, it's quite interesting. I lost the page, so give me a minute to find it. Yeah, this is a Siddur Rashi. So the author of this parish found it in Rashi's Siddur. Look what he says, really, really fascinating metaphor. Doma, this is like Kamisha Omer Lamachazer al Habsachim. You say to somebody who's going around begging, I just had this like a half hour ago, somebody came to my door asking for money for Achnasas Kala. It's not a very lovely position to be in where you need to go door to door begging. So you tell this guy, you know, you give him your tzedakah and say, hey, tomorrow you're going to be king. Like, what? Poor guy doesn't have enough money to buy bread. He's got to go around begging at doorsteps. And you tell him, oh, tomorrow you're going to be king. Like, ain't no mama. He's not going to believe it. In other words, what Rashi is saying is that our imagination is stymied by oppression. We can't even imagine a different or better future. Sometimes we are so stuck or captured in the challenges of the moment that our ability to imagine a different future is completely blocked off. Our imagination is not working. We just can't imagine things. We're so stuck with the difficulties of the present that our imaginations are just blocked. It's as if somebody were to say, you're going to be king and you're a beggar. It doesn't enter. You can't even imagine it. Forget about believe it. It's not there, so you're not going to believe it. You can't even imagine such a thing, which is another way of formulating how stress and oppression can afflict us. The first reading was it's stress and anxiety. And the second one, it's a stunting of our imaginative ability to think about things differently. So that's Musaf Rashi. The Ramban has a different interpretation, and that is fear of death. The Jews were simply afraid they would be killed by Paro. That's not generalized anxiety or generalized stress. It's a particular fear that something bad will happen to you. And you see people during the pandemic, this is especially true back in the spring, not so much now, although things are getting worse, but Baruch Hashem, they are not as bad in New York as they are elsewhere, and they're not as bad in New York as they were back in the spring. But some people had this generalized anxiety, which was crippling. Some people didn't have this generalized anxiety. They were specifically afraid that that person would get COVID and die. It's a much more focused kind of fear, and that's the Ramban. The Targum Yonasan, which is one of the Targumim, the translations into Aramaic of the Torah, has a different reading. Also interesting, all these different readings of Koser Ruach, kind of an anatomy of distress. So the Targum Yonasan uses the word mikpidus rucha, which in Hebrew would be kapdanut, which is somebody who is irascible, short-tempered, who is a kapdan, who like gets angry at the slightest thing, even the slightest variation from what he or she wants. You get really upset and really angry. And that's another kind of emotional response to stress. People who are under tremendous stress often have no tolerance for any deviation from what they expect. They just explode. It's not like in the true and narrow, they just explode. And I'm sure you've met people like that as well. When they're under stress, their tempers get bad, they're difficult to deal with, they can't tolerate anything. I'm sure you've seen, if not yourself, then other people you know who've responded to distress and stress in that way. People become very impatient. They just don't have that patience. They can't deal with things, simply can't deal with things, which is another reading of the psychological manifestation of stress. And finally, there is the Or HaChaim. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh, which also appears in the Chumash. Here's what he says. Ulai ki letzacho lo hayu b'nei Torah lo shamu. What he says is that the study of Torah gives one harchavat lev. It broadens the mind, it broadens the heart. Somebody who is engaged in ongoing Talmud Torah, ongoing learning of Torah, that brings a certain stability to them, certain capacity to focus on holy things, on Svarim HaKadoshim, on holy Svarim that we learn. It enables you to see different points of view. I just read you the Medrash. Rabbi Yishmael said one thing, Rabbi Akiva said another thing. You're always looking at different angles. And I think this may be, you know, another aspect of what the Or HaChaim is saying, the Talmud Torah provides harchavat hadat, broadness of thinking, because you're always looking at different angles. And it, by the way, it's true of great Talmidei Chachamim and other wise people, that they have the gift of looking at a problem from fresh and different perspectives. They're not locked into one way of looking at things. Because if you learn a lot, you're used to looking at different perspectives. The Gemara says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, about debates in the Gemara. They both have an element of truth. And so if you can always look at the different angles of truth, you'll have the capacity to look at the pressures of the moment and the difficulties of the moment from other perspectives. You can get another angle. Plus, you've got the stability that and aspirations that come from sustained Talmud. So for all of these different reasons, then I just find this analysis, all these different reasons, such provides different perspectives on what it means to be stuck, which, as I've been saying, many of us, certainly during the spring and to some extent now, feel this, kotze ruach. We might be short-tempered as a result of our stress from the pandemic. We might be afraid. We might have generalized anxiety. We might feel out of breath from stress and physiologically affected. There are all different kinds of ways in which the getting thrown under the brick, so to speak, can manifest itself in a similar way in our own lives. Now, what is the avoda kasha? The Torah says two things. It says kotza ruach and avoda kasha. So what's the avoda kasha, the hard work that prevented Jews from hearing Moshe Rabbeinu's message of a future redemption? So the simple pshat is that they were working very hard. And I think many of us have experienced this in our lives. You know, when we're so swamped at work, and I'm sure it's most people have had this experience at least sometime in their working lives. And some people have this experience a lot in their working lives. And I myself, since I have do a couple of things, sometimes I really feel this way. You know, there's just so many things you have to do, you don't know where to begin. And when you're in that place that you just, where do I turn now? It's hard to focus on other things. Hard work is not just as bad as it is really hard work, but you feel just so swamped that you can't kind of like get out of or figure out how to get out of it. You need to, of course, the solution is, well, what do I have to do today? Let's prioritize it. Let me make a checklist. There are ways of coping with that swamp, of being swamped with many things to do at the same time. I certainly felt that way, by the way, during the crush of COVID during the spring. There was just an infinite amount of things for me to do, both at the school and also with the shul. There's so many things I didn't know where to begin. And that is a barrier. One needs to figure out how to deal with that barrier. And sometimes we do better jobs at it than others. And thank God for Shabbos, right? That's the time to get out of the swamp. Shabbos has that great gift of liberating us from that swamp of exceedingly hard work when we're in that stage of our lives that we are bombarded by work. So really thank God for Shabbos. But that's in any case, one reading of Avoda Kasha. Bnei Yisrael didn't have Shabbos. This is before Shabbos in its rhyme. However, the Targum Yonasan, back to the Targum Yonasan, and a Medrash as well, provide a different reading of Avoda Kasha, which is not the pshat, not the simple reading, but it's interesting. And I'll read you the words of the Targum Yonasan, which I have handy. Pulchana nuchra'ah. Anybody know Aramaic well enough to figure that out? Pulchana nuchra'ah. So nuchra'ah is the Aramaic version of nachri. And pulchan is the Aramaic word of avoda.
Avodah zara.
Avodah zara, exactly correct. Exactly correct. Pulchana nuchra'ah is avodah zara, serving an alien god, a nachri god. And what the Targum Yonasan and a Medrash says this as well, is that the Avoda Kasha was that, as you know, very famously, B'nai Yisrael had sunk to the Memtes Sha'arei Tumah in Mitzrayim, and they were all over the Avodah Zarah. As another famous Medrash says, before Kriyas Yamsuf, the Malachim said to Hashem, like, why are you saving these people? Halalo of the Avodah Zarah, halalo of the Avodah Zarah. The Egyptians worship pagan gods and the Jews worship pagan gods. So why are you killing the Egyptians instead of the Jews? They're all over the Avodah Zarah. So what Targum Yonason is saying is that, and I think this operates at two levels. One level is that the Jews just didn't have that belief. They weren't convinced that Hashem would be able to beat the Egyptian gods in a boxing match. They weren't convinced. It's not that they didn't believe that Hashem existed, but they believed that lots of gods existed, and they weren't convinced that our God could beat the Egyptian gods in a wrestling match. And so that's one part of it. But there's another way of thinking at it as well, about it as well, which I think speaks more to all of us in our lives than perhaps that reading, which is that we all get so used to thinking about things in a certain way, doing things in a certain way, we fall into a kind of a rut. And it's hard for us to break from that rut. The habits of our lives, the habits of looking at things in a certain way, thinking about things in a certain way, you fall into a certain rut, and you don't question it. It just becomes a part of the furniture of your mind. By the way, one of the great charms of hanging around little kids is that they don't have that furniture in their minds. And so they look at things with a totally fresh perspective. I think I was just reading in the Wall Street Journal about the grandson of a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He was saying he was watching his grandson, like he's sitting in the high chair, and he was watching his grandson throw food onto the floor from the high chair, and then he would look over to the side of the high chair to see where the food landed. And he said, that's a kind of a nice scientific experiment. Hey, where's that food? Oh, look at that, it's down there, you know? Surprised, the kid was surprised. Hey, look, that's where the food is. Of course, only a grandfather could appreciate this. The mother or father who has to clean up after the mess of the child may be a little bit less appreciative of the charm of a kid doing scientific experiments with a cereal, mushy cereal, a different story. But in any case, the kid was looking at the world afresh. Is that where the stuff goes? Is it really going down there? You know, we're just used to thinking about experiencing things in a certain way. And part of the furniture of the lives of ancient Jews in Mitzrayim was like, you know, there are different gods, and but they weren't ready to hear and think about Hashem, who could take them out of Mitzrayim and bring them to Eretz Yisrael. In other words, it's a matter of habituated ways of looking at things. Now, in that case, there was Avodah Zarah ways of looking at things, which was quite relevant, but it's not just that their theology was wrong. It's just that they became too habituated. They couldn't get out of the rut of looking at the world in a certain kind of way. And all of us, you know, feel that way, are that way sometimes. It's hard for us to hear fresh new ways of looking at the world, making changes to our lives. That's really what Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur are about. You know, to question the assumptions of our daily, regular, get up in the morning, turn on the radio, you know, whatever we do, brush our teeth, you know, that's fine, brush your teeth. But it's just the routines of life. It's hard to break away from the routines. And by the way, the pandemic did have that effect. It did break some of our routines. Whether it enabled us to find Hashem afresh is another question. But that's another way of looking at the dangers of Avodah Zarah. In any case, so how does Hashem, and with this I'll conclude, how does Hashem respond to this? So Hashem says, I'm the four Lashonis of Gulav, Lakakti, Vesi, I'll take you a new vision, new world, new redemption, give you the Torah, I'll bring you to Eretz Yisrael, and the Jews, the Kotz of Ruach Mevodah Kasha, can hear that. So what's Hashem's solution to that? What's the solution? What are we supposed to do? What does Hashem want us to do? So I'll read you the pasuk that follows right after that, shortly after that. It says, Moshe spoke to Bnei Yisrael. They didn't listen to Hashem, Mikotzer Ruach, and the Avodah Kasha. And then immediately Hashem says, Vaydabar Shem Moshe Leimar, Bo daber al paro melech Mitzrayim vishalach es b'nei Yisrael me'atza. Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, take action. The only solution, or the best solution, to the traps of Avodah Kasha and of Kotzer Ruach is make it happen. As a leader, and Moshe Rabbeinu was a leader. He was the leader of Klal Yisrael, together with Aaron. They were told to go, don't be stuck in the same stuck place as the Jewish people are. Hashem says, I hear it. They're not listening to you. Got it. That's too bad. You take action. Don't pay any attention to them. They're stuck. It's tragic. It's sad. It's unfortunate. But you can make a difference without them by unilaterally going to Paro and demanding freedom of Bnei Yisrael. Even if they're not following, they can't believe you. L'shamua Moshe, but you make it happen. A leader's responsibility, like Nachshon ben Aminadav, remember the story of Nachshon ben Aminadav, Kriyas Yamsun, all the Jews were all stuck at the sea. The Mitzrayim were chasing them. The sea hadn't split yet. And then Nachshon ben Aminadav, Mishevet Yehuda, he leapt into the sea and the sea split after he leapt into it. Just to say that leaders, and Nachshon was a part of the family of leadership, have a responsibility of taking unilateral action if it's for the greater good of the community, even if the community is not yet ready to follow in their footsteps. And you may leave them behind, but if, like Nachshon ben Aminadav, you can leap in and split the sea and crack the resistance, they will come and follow. And we see that time and again in history. Great leaders can transform circumstances, and eventually people come to follow them. And that's a mark of the charismatic leader. Moshe Rabbeinu was more than charismatic. He was the shliach of Hashem himself. And through him, he mediated Hashem's presence. But what Hashem was challenging Moshe was to be the kind of courageous leader who sometimes doesn't look at the polls, right? If Moshe Rabbeinu had polled Bnei Yisrael, guess what? They would have said, stay right where you are. But sometimes leaders need to abandon the polls, even abandon people behind them, if they are convinced, as Moshe Rabbeinu was, because Hashem told him after all, to courageously move forward, and eventually people will follow, which is to say, and here's the main point I want to make, that community can suffer from kotzer ruach and avodah kasha. It could be during a pandemic or during a war. It could be many different circumstances. But if a leader has, in Moshe Rabbeinu's case, a divinely inspired vision of a different future, and even if it's not a divinely inspired, how many Moshe Rabbeinus do we have? But if any leader can, through force of personality and conviction about what's right and what's good and what's true, can jump forward, then that can crack the kotzer ruach and avodah kasha, which is to say, even if a people, a community is afflicted by depression, anxiety, stress, fear, great leaders have the capacity to crack through that. They can make a difference. Like Nachshon ben Aminadav, they leap into the sea and then the sea splits and people fall. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that Bnei Yisrael, we're stuck. But to be stuck is not to be hopeless. And it is the task of all leaders of a community, when called upon, depending upon the circumstances, but when it's right to do so, to courageously strike forward, even if their community is not ready for the courage they evince and manifest. And at least in Moshe Rabbeinu's case, it worked. Hashem punished Paro, the Makos came, the Bnei Yisrael redeemed. So Moshe Rabbeinu is special. Those are special circumstances. Can't overgeneralize. But that said, I do think it's a lesson for us to think about the ways in which a great leader can transform a paralyzed community.